Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Alistair McIntosh. He's been described by BBC TV as one of the world's leading environmental campaigners. A pioneer of modern land reform in Scotland, he helped bring the Isle of Eigg into community ownership. On the Isle of Harris, he negotiated withdrawal of the world's biggest cement company, Lafarge, from a devastating super quarry plan, then agreed to serve unpaid on that company's sustainability stakeholders panel for 10 years. His guest lectures at military staff colleges, most noticeably the UK Defence Academy on nonviolence. His books include Soil and Soul, People vs. Corporate Power, Hell and High Water, Climate Change, Hope and the Human Condition, Rekindling Community, and Spiritual Activism, Leadership as Service. His most recent major work is Poacher's Pilgrimage, An Island Journey. He's a fellow of the School of Divinity at the University of Edinburgh and a visiting professor at the College of Social Sciences, University of Glasgow. His website is www.alastairmcintosch.com and Twitter at alastairmci. So first, thank you for your work in the world, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Oh, it's lovely to be talking with you, Derek.
So let's start with the question of what is community and what is the relationship between community and the land?
Well, you're diving in deep there, because I distinguish between community and society. We often take those two words as a synonym, but I think community is something very much deeper. I called my best-known book Soil and Soul because it was about relationship with the land, with land reform, with environmental protection, like protecting the mountain that was threatened with a super quarry that you mentioned. And when I was discussing that, oh, I'm talking 20-odd years ago now, when I was discussing that with my friend Satish Kumar at Schumacher College, he said, you know, we could add another one to that, Soil, Soul and Society. And in fact, his most recent book is along the lines of that title. And it's a wonderful addition because I think that community involves those three pillars. Soil, our relationship with the land. What it means to be a community of place as distinct from merely a community of interests. Soul, which leads you into the question of what does it mean to be a human being? Are we just egos walking about on legs of meat? Or is there very much more to our being than that? Are we somehow profoundly interconnected? And is consciousness something that is perhaps bigger than just our own individual sense of awareness, but something that might have, as you would say, a cosmic property? Soil, soul, and society. Our connection with one another, our relationships with one another. So I'm talking, when I talk about community, as the interaction between the natural environment and the social environment, but together with an ontology, an understanding of what human being is about, that deepens that vertically through the normal psychological into the depth psychological, and if it is a meaningful concept for a person, into what we might call the spiritual.
So that all is really beautiful, and can you ground it for me? That's a really nice overview, and now can we talk more specifically about what it actually means? And if you want to put it in context of like that super quarry, that's fine. If you don't, that's fine too.
Okay. What does community in this deep sense actually mean? It means, first of all, that like the earthworm, we are organisms of the soil. That we are deeply animals of this planet, with all that that entails, including, you know, our whole DNA structure and our evolutionary trajectory and what have you. And as such,
We are creatures of habitat. Habitat is the environmental and social context of community. And because of the soul element, because of the element of us which is, or which can be, if we choose to develop it, profoundly conscious, that draws us into what the Brazilian educator Paulo Freire refers to as conscientization. It sounds much better in the original Portuguese, but by conscientization, he basically means coming into our full humanity, bringing together conscience and consciousness. Now, what that means is that when we find ourselves in a state of disconnect, in a state of desolation, or as the Jesuits would emphasize, that means desolation, i.e. you are no longer constellated around the sun, around the heart of your being. When we find ourselves in such states of desolation, because of what we might be experiencing in our life and our world, it invites us to the possibility that there might be deeper reaches and deeper resources of human being with which we can resource our activism, our actions for change. And this is what myself and a few others speak of as spiritual activism. In other words, if we are only doing our activism, take, for example, land reform or environmental protection, take, for example, the fact that I'm speaking to you here from Govan in Glasgow, which is a hard-pressed area, the former shipbuilding area, with all the social problems you normally get. And so the issues of urban poverty that we have here, if we are only coming at that from a conventional level of bringing about social change, we so readily either burn out or sell out. And I'm interested in what happens, recognizing those dangers, recognizing how many activists have come to that. I'm interested in how we can be in it for the long run, for a lifetime. In other words, how can we drill down into deeper sources of being energized, deeper sources of carrying the suffering that is all around us and which we might experience ourselves? Is there something deeper that we can dig down into? And if so, how can that take shape to help resource our activism?
So there's a few directions that I'm thinking, and I'm gonna say a couple of things, and you can take this any direction you want.
Yeah, sure.
One of them is I was speaking with someone a year ago about how community is continuing to evolve in the computer age, such that at one point we were place-based, and he now says that we're moving, and he's not promoting this. This is like a weatherman or a person.
Yeah, he's just observing what's happening. Yeah.
Yes, and he said that we're moving toward what he called aspiration-based, where it's not even interest-based, but you can have an avatar on you can be online and pretend that you are a hobbit from the Lord of the Rings, and you will get together with other hobbits.
And that's
an extreme example, but when he first told me that, I almost started crying because it is so horrifying to me and so ungrounded.
I would completely agree. And I think, you know, I was reading something the other day about, you know, the idea of, what's they call it, cyborgs or something like that, the idea of combining human with the machine. I mean, at a certain level, you're talking to one here, because I'm only able to talk to you just now, because I've got very powerful hearing aids. I'm very deaf otherwise. So partly I am a combination of human and a machine, but not in any sense that goes into the soul. That's purely to augment a sensory deficiency. But what troubled me in reading up about this, is the term they use cyborg? Do you know him?
Yes. It applies to me as well.
That is the term, is it? Yes. Okay. They're basically talking about, you know, we're on the trajectory to become post-human. We're on a trajectory to transcend what it means to be human. And I'm kind of thinking, hang on a minute, you know, how about trying just being human? How about having a human experience first? It's a bit like some of the Buddhist teachers say, you know, when the students go on saying, oh, I'm trying to get into a space of no self. And some of the wiser Buddhist teachers will say, well, actually, first of all, you have to develop yourself before you can move on to no self. So when I hear the kind of thing you've just been talking about, I think, wait a minute, this sounds to me like yet another escape from the reality of being here now, of being grounded in our communities of place. And yes, okay, we all have communities of interest. I'm connecting with you and your people because we are a community of interests that are activists. But that only makes sense if we are doing our activism in an embodied place, in amongst, you know, what the, I was raised in the Isle of Lewis in Scotland's Outer Hebrides, and one of our poets, Ian Crichton Smith, wrote a major essay. He called it Real People in a Real Place. And Ian's concern was that we were losing touch with what it means to be real people in a real place. So, you know, before heading off into these internet realities and losing ourselves in fantasy existences, literally losing ourselves, becoming detached, deranged in these internet fantasies, I would say let's just ground ourselves here. Let's learn what it means to be real. And one way we can do that is by activism to make things more real in our place. So just to round off on that, I was talking to one of my colleagues here, Luke Devlin, the other day, and we're discussing what is it that those of us who are older, like, you know, I'm 62 now, I think I'm about 5 years or so older than you are, and what can the likes of us most helpfully do for the younger generation? And you know what he said? He says, anything that can't be done with a computer. In other words, having real contact with real people in real places doing real things.
Okay, another, and I'm sorry if I'm throwing things from many directions.
No, that's fine. Am I making sense to you? Is this having traction with you?
No, you're making perfect sense, and this is
good.
This is profoundly moving to me, and I'm presuming it will be for the listeners as well.
Well, I think, you know, the kind of people you are reaching out to from, if I can just infer it from bits and pieces I've picked up over the years on the internet and stuff that you've been writing, and particularly those of my students who you've been an important influence on, the kind of thing that they're most deeply searching for is how to have meaning, how to have authentic meaning, how to, you're not a fabricated, simulated sense of meaning, but to be real. They just want to be real, and they want relationships that are real, that are embodied in the heart and embodied in practical actions like sharing food and digging ground, and even, you know, I'll take young men out in my inflatable canoe and take them fishing for mackerel in the summer, that kind of stuff, to connect them with where food comes from, all of that stuff.
Yeah, I have a good friend who is an activist who says that central to his activism is having lunch with people.
Beautiful.
That before beautiful. We can go to a protest, I mean, yeah, protests are incredibly important, but he said, I don't want to go to the protest with you if I haven't, you know, to use the cliche, broken bread with you, if I haven't eaten with you and I don't know who you are.
There you go. When I was, you know, my first job when I graduated in 1977, I went and did your American equivalent of Peace Corps. We call it Voluntary Service Overseas. I got sent to Papua New Guinea. And I read a book by the then Prime Minister of Papua New Guinea, Michael Somare, and he told this wonderful story. He said, okay, you know, in our part of the world, we have tribal fighting. Well, we all have that, but in different ways. And he says, but we've got this rule that before you have a fight, each tribe has to put together as much food as they can bring, and you all come down to the beach, and you have a big feast together. Now, if you still feel like fighting after you've had the feast, okay, get on and fight. But you see the point that when you break bread together, and, you know, I think of Gerard Winstanley, the English activist of the 17th century, the digger, you know, you've heard of the diggers. He says, break laws like you break the bread. Or so it's attributed to him as saying, when you break bread together, then community happens. Why is it that the most frequently cited miracle of Jesus in the four gospels is the feeding of the multitude, variously 3,000 to 5,000? It's because by breaking bread together, they subverted the role of empire, which was to put on bread and circuses. And they subverted the role of empire with that authenticity. So I think this kind of groundedness is what we're talking about, Derek. And when people say to me, how can I be an activist? You know, I don't have the skills that you've got or something like that. I say to them, well, can you cook? You know, can you work a photocopier? That kind of thing. Learn a very simple skill and then apply it. And then the magic of community, the magic of love starts to happen.
So I love what you're saying, and I want to tell a little bit of a story that leads to a, I think, very difficult question for myself, and maybe it will be easy for you. And that's, I have a friend, Jeanette Armstrong, who is an Okanagan Indian, a writer and activist.
Okay.
And she once said to me that, you know, we Indians have the same problem as white people do, in that we still fight, you know, we still don't like each other. And the big difference is that we're going to be living on this same land for 500 years. And so I recognize my great-grandchildren might have to marry your great-grandchildren, and so we have to find a way to get along.
Exactly.
Okay, so that's part one. Part two is one of their ways to get along in their own community is their version of this feast before the fight, which is they have a process that they call Anaukin. And the process is, what Anaukin means is, I challenge you to give me your most opposite perspective to mine so I can increase my understanding.
Oh, beautiful.
And so what will happen is, if you and I disagree, then we go to the community, and a trained facilitator will say, you know, each of you, give me your most opposite perspective, and you work it out. Okay, that's all great. That's the wonderful part. Now, here's the difficult part, is that she also said that the key to this is it only works if you're working with people in community, and it doesn't work when you try it with someone who wants what you've got. You see what I'm getting at?
Interesting. So, interesting. That's so interesting.
So
that's so interesting.
So, for example, they couldn't do the Anaukin process with the companies that are right now trying to put in dams on their land.
Yeah.
So I'm just going to throw all that at you and see where you take it.
Yeah. Well, I would slightly disagree with that, in that I think the name of the game when we are in conflict, which activism often entails, is that you have to reach through to the humanity of your adversary. Now, how do you do that? For me, a starting point, and I am a Quaker by conviction, so that influences what I am saying here, is that you seek what in Quakerism we call that of God in everybody. You assume that at some deep level, perhaps very buried, there is the divine spark in the other. Now, when you do that, it brings a peculiar power. This is really the essence of spiritual activism. Because if you respond to your adversary from a point where, yes, you are causing confrontation, even obstruction, but nevertheless, you are trying to seek out that which is most honorable in the potential in your adversary, in my experience, it can very often help to shift things. I had that with the, you mentioned the super quarry where a company was going to put what was going to be the biggest roadstone quarry in the world on a mountain in our island in a national scenic area in the Outer Hebrides. And as that campaign developed and I came into relationship with the corporate executives, I was able to get through to them at a level of their values and literally say to them, you know, look, folks, you've all got to these positions of being vice presidents of the biggest cement company in the world by virtue of who you are and the skills you've got, and you've probably made as much money as you're ever going to need. But what's going to happen when you sit your grandchildren on your knee and they ask you, what did you do, granddad, to make the world a better place? And so I think that sometimes you can get through in unexpected quarters like that. I'll give you another example. Last week I was teaching a course in spiritual activism here in Scotland, a week-long course. And there was a guy there who had mentioned in his introduction that he had been a soldier, but he said he didn't want to talk about it. And I kind of said, special forces? And he said, yeah. And I said, okay, fair enough. We won't go there unless you want to. And later in the week he came to me and he started telling me about it, and he told me this story, which resonated in with some other story that I'd been telling, that basically what he was doing, and he told me I could use this story, obviously not naming him, basically what he had been doing back in the apartheid era is that he had been in the special forces whose task it was to go around rural areas in South Africa, go into village communities, search the houses for any liberation material or any sign that they were part of the anti-apartheid movement. And if they were, to destroy the whole village, they had to raise the whole village. So there they were on this particular occasion, and there were various operations taking place. There were helicopters flying around in the sky. There was smoke coming up from other villages that had been raised, and he and his group of men came to this village, which had a high stockade around it, and they made their way in. Apparently, whenever they went into these places, it would be deserted because the inhabitants would have fled to avoid capture. And they started searching the house, and they found in one of the houses liberation material. And he was about to give the order to set fire to the village when, out of kind of nowhere, must have been hiding in one of the houses or something, a woman emerged. And the woman just walked slowly towards him with most enormous dignity of presence and just stared gently into his eyes. And he turned to his men and said, okay, out of here. Now that's the kind of way in which sometimes you can reach unexpectedly. That said, because let's just go back, and the point you were making is that the difficulty with sharing honestly, with being able to see the other person's point of view, if the other person is using asymmetric power and is not on side with you, the difficulty then is that it might not work. That said, I would have to acknowledge that sometimes that is the case. For example, a key part of spiritual activism revolves around discernment. Now, again, in the Quaker tradition that I'm coming from, discernment, properly understood, is not about the me, it's not even about the we, it is about discerning the movement, the leading, the promptings of the deep spirit of life. From a Christian perspective, it would be said the Holy Spirit, but that language might not do the trick for everybody. Let's just call it the deep spirit of life that moves through us all, assuming that we are spiritually interconnected. And in Quaker discernment process, particularly a process we call meetings for clearness, where you try to seek clearness, helped by the discernment of the community. The idea is you gather initially in silence and wait for leading, wait for insights from that deep level that might speak to the situation. Now, what I have noticed, because I've often used that as a decision-making process, like we use it in Quakerism, I've often used it with groups that are not of a spiritual nature. And I found it very difficult because they don't trust to that deep spirit. And so the ego kicks in, and in no time, you know, one person's ego comes in, another person interacts with that, and it breaks down into a normal conversation rather than a spiritual discernment. So I would partly agree with your Native American friends and what they've said, and I would partly disagree with it. You know, as usual, Derek, in so many of these things, the opposite of one great truth is another great truth. And I can see that on both ways.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. And I'm thinking a couple things. One of them is that I'm thinking about how this, did you call it spiritual discernment?
Yes, spiritual discernment.
Mm. I'm thinking about the relationship between that and time.
Oh, beautiful. And, oh, you're tripping me out. I love it.
How, I don't know how it is when you write, but when I write, oftentimes I can try to, the only thing I can tell about my writing is whether, I can usually tell if I'm writing stuff that's crap. And if I'm writing stuff that's crap, I can't force it to be good, but what I can do is stop writing and take a walk. And it may take 3 minutes of walking, or it may take 3 weeks, or it may take 3 months, and then it will come. So the spiritual discernment feels very similar to me to the relationship with the muse. It seems like those are parts of the same story.
Oh, you betcha, yeah.
And for me, another thing I've noticed, and I don't know if this is your experience as well, but I can sit here inside and I may or may not, the muse may or may not speak to me, but walking through a forest, walking, interacting with the land, or sitting on the land, sitting with the land, for me, there can be times I'm stuck for hours not knowing what to say, and I can literally walk through a forest for 5 minutes, and something comes. And so, is there, do you want to just mention the relationship between spiritual discernment, time, and the land?
Well, I think it's the reason I said you're tripping me out is that I think that any deep discernment, any deep writing or other art form, probably any deep science and any deep activism is about starting to understand this moment of time in the context of eternal time. And this is something that I've very much written about in my most recent book, Poacher's Pilgrimage, An Island Journey. Because I'm walking into my own island. I go back for 12 days to the island of Lewis and Harris, and I walk for 12 days through the islands, for 4 days meeting nobody at all out in the mountains and so on. And I'm walking into what I call an ecology of the imagination. And what starts happening to one's psyche in that context, I think I can generalize, it's not just me, many people have noticed this when in wilderness contexts, is that your sense of time starts deepening out of the, well, it's not so much you deepen out of the present moment, you actually deepen into the present moment, but you realize that the present moment is an opening into eternity. And that, as Plato put it, time is a moving image of eternity, but it's like you widen the aperture with which you're looking through. So instead of just seeing a little bit, you widen into a sense of something much bigger and much deeper, that which is holy, that which is sacred, to the point where I find myself asking, is it that we just have imaginations that are generated in our individual brains? And that we have consciousness that is generated in our individual brains? Or is it more like, particularly Hindu theology would say, that we move in the deep imaginal realm? That we move in consciousness and our brain kind of tunes in to a particular wavelength that we're able to cope with at this time. And for me, that is germane to the writing process. So I use the metaphor fairy a lot because I'm coming out of a cultural tradition in which the old belief system was about the Shia, the fairies. The word she in Gaelic means both fairy and peace. And don't laugh, because there is an extensive body of Scottish scholarship now from some of our leading ethnographers, people like John McInnes, Margaret Bennett, Ronald Black, mainly of the School of Scottish Studies at Edinburgh University, who have documented this belief system, a belief system which still carries on into the present day. There's still parts of it alive in the present day, and it's basically about stepping into timelessness. You fall down the fairy hill, or you get taken away by the fairies and the vision, and you are into a realm of timelessness from where, as John McInnes, the greatest living Gaelic scholar, puts it in one of his essays on Gaelic metaphysics, he says, it is from this realm that the creative power of humankind derives. In other words, from the realm where you have stepped back from being locked into a rigid formulation of space and time, and you realize that most of the time we don't know what we are inside of, that we are moving in something much bigger. As Nora Bateson, one of the daughters of Gregory Bateson, who wrote Steps to an Ecology of Mind, put it to me when I said to her, you know, what was your dad really trying to get at in that famous 1972 book? And she said, I think he was trying to show us that we don't know what it is that we are inside of. And so to me, the creative process is, and the activist context, the activist process that is tied in with that, because activism is a very creative process, comes from that being able to see the bigger picture. And to be being able to see that this bigger picture is cosmological. You know, I was raised in the Outer Hebrides of Scotland, and whenever I'm back there on a clear night with no moon, I'll just go out and I'll stand under the stars and I'll look up and I'll say, you know, whatever's happening on Earth, this is a cosmological context. This is the environment of which we are an integral part. We are stardust. We are golden. And we've got to make it back to the garden, as the Woodstock song had it.
So as you're talking, I keep thinking about one of my books, Dreams, is really about when I talk about a muse. I mean, when you say about the fairies, I would never laugh at that. My own belief is that the muse is an actual being with.
Interesting.
So the muse is not accessing some part of myself. The muse is listening. And I love the line by Albrecht Dürer, art is inherent in nature, and whoever can extract it has it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't really like the word extract because of extract.
No, I was going to say, I quibble with that.
Me too.
It's basically whoever would be,
whoever can
receive it. Whoever, I mean, what you're touching on here leads us straight into grief.
Well, I'm gonna, okay,
that's
I'm gonna change,
let's, gift of grief.
I'm gonna change the Albrecht Dürer quote, and let's see if you like this better. I like this better. Art is inherent in nature. We both like that, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Whoever can accept that gift has it.
Beautiful. Okay. Beautiful. And you know,
Wait, are you still there?
Reading just recently, and his wonderful in activism of the imperative of generosity. You know, we started off talking about sharing food and breaking bread together. That dynamic of generosity is so critical.
Are you there?
Are you still with me? Yeah, yeah, I'm sorry. I think that was it was actually my mother trying to call me and into accepting. That's what happened. I beg your pardon. I don't know how that happened. Okay, did you get me there? Did you get what I said about the gift, Lewis Hyde, and the gift must always move? The dynamic of generosity, that by cultivating a spirit of generosity, by cultivating a spirit of gratitude and passing it on, we magnify what is there. Hello?
Hello?
Yep, yep. Did you catch me there?
If it's okay with you, I will try to get somebody, I don't know how to do it, but I will try to get somebody else to edit this for me. Could you could you start over again from where I said the thing about who art is inherent in nature and whoever can accept the gift has it?
I think what you're touching on with the gift there is of massive importance to activism. In his book, The Gift, Lewis Hyde has this wonderful expression that the gift must always move. And that when we are engaged with creative endeavor, it's not about me and my creativity. It's about a gift that is given to us. And the more open-hearted we are in how we share that and how we cultivate the gift on in others, both in our creativity and in our activism, the more it will move, the bigger it will become. If we want to change the world, we have to learn how to work with the dynamics of grace, which is to say, gift. And then, as we change from within, so the politics out with start to shift also. That's the only way I make sense of it.
I heard what you said, but I didn't understand the last phrase. Can you help me understand the part about the politics out with?
Okay. I'm sorry. I'm using a Scottish word there. Out with, meaning outside of. And what I'm getting at there is that so much conventional activism, so much conventional politics assumes that all we need to do is change the political system to have a revolution or whatever. That's what we need to do. And then the new order, the new millennium can begin. And my belief and experience that it doesn't quite work like that. It partly works like that. The political engagement is a very important part of it. But you're only going to get the politics that people are inwardly ready for within themselves. And therefore, if we really want to do deep activism, we have to do the outer politics, like the politics of land reform that I've been involved with in Scotland, where we've now got 3% of Scotland's land, 500,000 acres, back into community land trust ownership. Or the super quarry, or the urban poverty issues here in Glasgow with the Galgale Trust, which I'm involved with. You can only do that effectively if you're working with people in a way that is changing them inwardly as well, so that they understand from within the new world, the different world we are moving to, and they're motivated from these sources within. And therefore, when we talk in the big picture, what are we going to do about the corporations or the governments and so on, we've got to face up to these things and see that in part we are seeing our own reflections back in their mirrors. And the more that we can work both with the inner dynamics, the psychology and spirituality of that in ourselves and with others around us, the better equipped and the more convincingly we will be ready to change the outer political realities.
You know, this reminds me of two things. One of them is so many indigenous people have said to me that the first and most important thing that we have to do is to decolonize our hearts and minds.
Yeah, I call it decolonization of the soul.
And
part and parcel of decolonizing the land.
Yes. And part of what I say when people ask me what we need to do is one of the things I say is we need to transfer our loyalty away from the capitalist system, from civilization, from the industrial system, from whatever you want to call it, and toward the land. And I think that we are using different terms to discuss things that are very similar. And I want to say one more thing, which is I'm writing a book right now with a couple people, and the title of the book is Bright Green Lies, and it's how solar and wind are not the answers to the problems that the world is facing. And one of the things that we talk to is at the very end of the book we say, the problem is that these are, one of the problems is that these are technical solutions to a problem primarily of values. And what really needs to change is, there's a great line by a climate activist saying that, you know, polar bears don't actually do it for me. And for me, that's the problem, is the idea that frogs don't do it for us, or that trees don't do it for us, polar bears, black bears, doesn't matter who. Give me a wonderful Scottish creature to throw in there.
A unicorn.
or to go with the discussion we had earlier, the fairies don't do it for us.
Yeah.
And for me, a lot of my work is about helping us to remember that, you know, for me at least, rough-skinned newts and black bears do it for me. And is that what you're talking about too? Part of it?
I think, you know, if you're here in Glasgow, I'll take you down to the Gal Gael Trust. The Gal means a stranger, the Gael means a heartland people. There's something of the stranger and something of the indigenous in all of us these days. And if I took you around our workshop, you would see wood carvings, huge life-size wood carvings of many of our indigenous species, the salmon, the otter, that kind of thing, but also ones that have gone extinct locally, like the lynx and the wild boar and what have you. And we see that as honouring the animal spirits of our place. And we build boats and we go out in the River Clyde and we reconnect people with their full community of place. We reconnect coastal communities. But what I would say is that the technology, I believe, is also important. It's the technology that's allowing us to speak across the Atlantic tonight. In the case of our own house here, I've got solar panels and an air-to-air source heat pump, and we have cut the carbon footprint of our house, measured over 5 years now, from 5.4 tons of carbon dioxide emissions a year to just over 1.9 tons, a reduction of 63%. And that's because of solar and heat pump technology. And our house is warmer and more comfortable than it's ever been before. That's thanks to the technology. And I think, you know, being fully human means fully connecting in our consciousness with what nature is about, what our environment is about. That's your soul, your soil element of community. It means fully connecting with the depth of our humanity, which is the soul dynamic, and connecting thereby fully with one another, in community with each other, in interconnection with each other, which is the society dynamic, soil, soul, and society. And I just, you know, if you ask me where my hope comes from, as distinct from my optimism, I don't have much optimism, but I have a lot of hope. My hope is that whatever is happening in the world just now, it is an opportunity to deepen consciousness. an opportunity to deepen consciousness of one another, of the whole planetary and cosmological context, an opportunity to deepen consciousness, perhaps, into the love that drives the sun and other stars around.
Well, thank you so much, and thank you for that beautiful, beautiful ending. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Alistair McIntosh. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.